Good day, folks. This is Shane Hasty for the InfoQ Culture Podcast. I'm here with Jeff Dalton. Jeff is the Chief Evangelist for Agile CXO, an organization doing research and development, particularly at the moment focused on agile leadership. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me, Shane.
Do you want to tell us a little bit first about yourself and your background, how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Well, that's a long story, but I'll try to keep it short for you. You know, I grew up in a musical family in New Zealand. You probably don't know who the Partridge Family is. It was a famous television show here in the U.S., but I actually grew up in the real version of that and traveled the country playing music when I was young and went to music school eventually and played in orchestras in Europe and in South America and here in the U.S. And in about 1985, someone gifted me a luggable computer, and this was an old Access CPM computer with the dot matrix printer on the top. It had a disc called QDOS with it, and I didn't know what that was in 1986, but I learned how to program, and I got a C compiler, and I learned how to do that, and I ultimately went back to school and got a degree in computer science, but it led to a whole career in software development, where I moved up into various ranks, and I worked for various companies like Microsoft and HP and General Motors even, and then culminated that with a few years in San Francisco with a dot-com called IntelliCorp, where I was running software engineering there. And then I split off in about 2001 and started my own company, and this company focused on rapid software development. And, of course, Agile was hardly Agile back then. It was called Rapid Application Development or Rapid Prototyping or had lots of different words for it back then before Agile became a household name. But we started doing assessments early on, and since then we've assessed close to 300 companies in terms of their cultural adoption of agility and their ability to collaborate and work together. And long before, you know, Scrum was well known or XP was well known or long before Scaled Agile Framework, we were assessing organizations for just how agile they were. And so Agile CXO is a company that we started a few years back that focuses on research around agile leadership. And we've developed some models based on our data around best practices for agile leadership. So that's what we're focusing on right now.
In your exploration of these 300-odd organizations, and you mentioned to me in our chatting earlier that a lot of them are the very big ones. Now, Agile is the flavor of the month. When we look at the adoption profile, it's the late majority, even the laggards are getting into Agile now. How well's that going?
Well, you know, this isn't a popular opinion, but based on the empirical data we've collected, it's not going well. The marketing of agility is going far better than the reality of agility for a lot of different reasons. So, you know, I always say it's the early adopters who kind of set the tone for adoption. And of course, the early adopters of Agile tended to be smaller, more compact organizations and really subsections of companies or organizations that were trying Agile, and they had great success with Scrum and XP and some of those things. But as it's scaled and as more and more big companies, the culture of the company is what really drives the behaviors of the people, right? And, you know, small startups or small subsections of teams, they tend to have very collaborative, transparent cultures. But when you start looking at companies like General Motors and the Department of Defense here in the U.S. and Lockheed Martin and Nationwide Insurance and a lot of these companies that have, you know, 300-400 teams sometimes working together, their culture is the culture of their company. And the reason that, you know, General Motors, and I'm just using them as kind of a metaphor because there are like a lot of big companies, the reason their software teams are very document heavy and very process heavy with lots of low trust oversight is because that's how the company operates. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with their software teams. It has to do with the culture of the company. Early on, I was very heavily involved in the capability maturity model, and that's something that has a reputation of being kind of a heavyweight, process burdened sort of a model. But the only reason people think that is because the early adopters were, you know, General Electric and General Motors and Lockheed Martin and the DoD, and These are companies that already were heavy, overburdened, overprocessed companies. So when they adopted Agile, what do you think they did? They made it heavy, overburdened. You know, most of these 300 companies have project managers that do tasking. They use Microsoft Project. They do a lot of things that you would think were Agile anti-patterns or antithetical to Agile values, and they all do them. And it's only the smallest companies that are, you know, running Scrum Project using the Scrum roles as defined in the Scrum Guide. Most companies of size that have, you know, 30, 40, 50 teams, they have project managers, they have architects, they have, you know, directors, they have process quality, they have audits, they have all the things that you would say Agile teams would never have. So we observed this early on and we said, hey, there's a culture clash. And, you know, you're a technical guy, so I'm sure you know what a type mismatch is in software.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we call it an organizational type mismatch. when the values of the company, the values and philosophy of the company are at odds with the values and philosophies of agility. So, of course, the 9 core Agile values, I'm sure you know, your listeners know them, collaboration and transparency and fail fast and all those types of things. They are directly antithetical to the corporate philosophies of, say, a company like General Electric, right? Where they're very much command and control, low trust, document focused, audit focused. So we noticed right away that even though senior management, CIOs and CTOs especially, were keen on becoming more agile, they weren't so keen on changing the corporate culture. And that itself was an impediment to their success and continues to be today. So that's why I say it's not going well.
But they all want the benefits of agility.
They sure do. But maybe we should talk about what the perceived benefits of agility are.
Isn't it just get something out the door quicker? And
get it faster and get it cheaper, right?
Yeah.
That's what they think. And I think, I mean, we're paraphrasing, but I think that's generally it. I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. First of all, the people at that level tend to be older and have, you know, been around the companies a lot longer. And I think Peter Drucker was the one that coined the phrase, climbing the greasy pole. He said, in order to become a leader at a large company, you have to climb the greasy pole. And the lessons you learn climbing that pole are decidedly anti-agile. You know, you learn lessons that are antithetical to agile values. And so when you're looking down at agile teams, you're saying, yeah, I want that benefit of faster and cheaper. But the real benefit of agility is softer than that. So for years, at least here in the U.S., maybe not so much where you are, but here in the U.S., soft skill values have been given short shrift. The values of collaboration, of employee satisfaction, of motivation, of willingness to work together, those things have been given short shrift. And that's the power of agility, in my view, that harnessing the power of the soft skills is what makes the team successful. And the magic to me of not only agile values, but tracing those values to the ceremonies and techniques that we adopt and making sure that traceability is solid brings us the power of those soft skills combined with the power of the hard skills. And I think senior management hasn't done a great job of making that connection and making that traceability. Mm-hmm. And that's hurt us in the industry. So it's real easy to do when you have a 10-person company, when the owner's sitting in the room and he comes in and he goes, hey, where are your boards? You know, what's going on here? And they can really get a feel for what's going on. I'll give you an example. I was doing an assessment at a really big insurance company. I think they had about 15 floors of developers. And the CIO said, yeah, we're agile top to bottom. We're all doing agile. We're the agilistas in the world. Go check it out. You're going to be so impressed. And we went and we walked around. We did like a gumbo walk kind of thing. And we found out that, you know, Scrum Masters were tasking people and beating people over the head for tasks. And we found that, you know, stand-ups were status meetings that went on for an hour. And we just found all this crazy stuff that is antithetical to what you and I would consider good practices, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem is the culture. Mm-hmm. It isn't that developers don't know how to do it. They do. It's just that leaders don't know how to drive it. Mm-hmm. And then they just let it get out of control, and it spirals down from there. So they really need help with that.
And you've come up with some advice on how to help them, teaching agile leaders how to teach
Well, in order to grasp that, you know, visualize that a big organization has many levels of leadership, right? Mm-hmm. This came to me once. I was at Chrysler, which is now called Fiat Chrysler. I'm here in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And we joke around. We say it's called Fiat Chrysler this week. A couple of years ago, it was Daimler Chrysler. And somebody said, oh, look at this org chart. Look where we're working. Isn't this awesome? And we were like 19 levels down from the CEO, yet the organization we were working with was massive. So these companies are massive, right? And there's many, many levels of leadership. And so the conclusion we came to is that leaders don't know how to teach other leaders how to teach their people and their leaders how to be agile. And it, you know, there's a couple of levels of indirection there. But if you imagine that I'm a CIO or a CTO or a VP of engineering, and I need to teach my directors, of which I might have 50, how to teach their supervisors and their managers how to maintain agility in a strict command and control environment, it's a real trick, right? Mm. So we came up with a model we call the Agile Performance Holarchy. This is just based on data that we've collected over the years. And the Agile Performance Holarchy breaks out teaching into six categories. And the first category is leadership, as you might imagine, because it's one thing to say I'm a leader and I may or may not know how to lead, but whether you can teach other leaders how to teach other leaders is a real trick, and it's really complicated. So we put together a set of best practices around leadership and how to teach other people how to lead. And that includes a set of agile techniques. So we focused on agility here, and we said, we don't need a new framework here. What we need is to leverage agility throughout the leadership chain vertically. So if you think about, you know, like take something like sprint planning, for instance, it's a very simple construct at the scrum team level. But imagine that you've got multiple dimensions of planning throughout the verticalness of the organization. So now you're looking at cascading plans, release plans, or I should say product plans, release plans, and sprint plans that might drive 8, 10, 20 scrum teams underneath it. And you build a model like that where the leaders themselves are doing sprint and release planning using those same constructs and those same techniques, using visual information indicators, using boards, using all the things that they tell their scrum teams to use at the CIO, CTO, and VP level, and drive that vertically throughout the organization. Now, multiply that across all of the Agile ceremonies, and you start learning what we have to teach leaders how to teach other leaders. Right? Here's all the techniques that other leaders need to know in order to succeed with Agile throughout the organization. So we've set up a learning model that supports that.
And how do you stop it being just lip service? I'm envisaging a retrospective that at the team level should be an opportunity to seriously examine how we're doing and to tackle hard questions and to genuinely identify ways to improve. How do you make it safe to do that at a very, very senior level?
No, that's a really good question. So we built an assessment model that uses retrospectives at multiple levels and uses enterprise retrospectives. So if you think about how Scrum of Scrums works, it's a little bit like that, where teams have their retrospectives, and then the next level of functional group has its retrospectives, and the next level of functional group. At some point, you're adding observation to that, because you can't depend on the information getting filtered up in an unbiased way, right? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't happen. So our model recommends observation, peer observation at each retrospective, and that, and those people follow the retrospectives uphill so that by the time you get to senior management, that information is being delivered by exactly the same people that absorbed it at the lower levels. So there's kind of a upwardly cascading retrospective, if you would, mm-hmm. that's combined with an observation methodology that assesses the organizations and rates each group in a level of 1 through 3. And those levels are called adopting, transforming, and mastering for that particular subject. So leading is only one of the 6 circles, what we call performance circles, that the curriculum is based on. We won't get into the other detail, but we have one for crafting, for craftsmanship. which focuses on more technical aspects.
Something that's been so overlooked.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote in the article that, you know, the re-emerging interest in craftsmanship is a great thing, but it's not nearly enough, right? So, you know, one of the things that I think the Agile movement has overlooked is this focus on technical capability. There's really very little in any of the Agile frameworks. Yeah. You know, XP's got some things, but they're really process-focused. So they're really not a whole lot different than CMMI or ITIL or ISO in the respect that they basically say, here's the process we expect to see, but it really doesn't get focused on the craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. So our craftsmanship model focuses on code quality and coding techniques and unit testing, which is, you know, and code reviews. And these are things that, you know, no offense to software organizations, but they're really dropping the ball on this.
Yeah.
These are opportunities to really create some outstanding applications that it's just not happening. So we have our craftsmanship circle. We also have our envisioning circle. And this came about because after really examining craftsmanship, we said, you know, code craftsmanship's not enough. It's super great and interesting that people are focusing on code craftsmanship, but what about story and vision craftsmanship? You know, the ability to create effective epics, user stories, connect them together, make them make sense. The industry generally is pretty bad at that. And what about craftsmanship when it comes to working together with end users and customers and bringing together those people with the developers? You know, out of 300 organizations, I think 270 of them had a surrogate product owner. This is really common in big companies, or they had a person in IT acting as product owner. So the notion of craftsmanship in what we call the envisioning circle, envisioning the solution, is something that we've built on. And the other ones, of course, we have one for teaming and how to teach people how to team. This is another big problem we have. And we also have one for what we call affirming, which is about quality. And this is something that's completely fell down the rabbit hole with Agile, is, you know, no one's really focusing on behavioral quality or code quality. It's really just, it's just not in there. So we're doing that. And the final part of the curriculum and the model is what we call providing. And this covers two areas. What Agile leaders need to provide to their teams: tools, automation, shared space, pair-programming desks, things like that is part of it. But the other part that's overlooked by so many teams that's so important is Agile procurement. We do a lot of state governments, and state governments suffer terribly from this, of course, because they farm everything out. So they'll say, we want to do this big project. You know, the state highway department wants to do a project. It's $40 million. We want to use Agile. We want to hire an Agile firm. So they go out and hire a big company that says they're Agile, and they write their contract tied to milestones. Or they write their contract tied to delivery of code instead of doing it by sprint or release or whatever makes much more sense, as opposed to a time and materials contract. So roping procurement into this and teaching them how agility works is an absolutely critical part for not just governments, but for really big companies. Mm-hmm. So it's a cohesive model with six components that focuses on what we believe are the biggest holes and the biggest problems. And we believe that leaders need to teach their leaders and other people in the company just how to make this work.
The leader's job is to teach. Surely we bring in external consultants like you to teach.
Yeah, you know, I've been a consultant all my life, and I always advise my client that it's a really bad idea. Consultants are super helpful, I think, and like I said, I've been one my whole life. They're super helpful for sharing information you don't know and for helping. I don't know if you read Gerald Weinberg's books, The Secrets of Consulting. He's fantastic. Yep. He talks about how to jiggle things so that they loosen up. Yep. And I just love his metaphors, but I mean, basically what he says about his books is consultants are really good to get you unstuck, but don't keep them around for too long, yeah. You know, because, you know, I always tell our clients, you know, you don't want me to walk out the door with the knowledge. You want to have the knowledge. You want to be the ones to learn from this. So teaching organizations how to teach and how to learn, I think, is the most valuable thing a consultant can do.
not many of them do that.
Well, there's revenue tied to hours, right?
Yeah. I saw a sign somewhere. Yeah, if you're not part of the solution, there's money to be made extending the problem.
Yeah. I had a client tell me that once when I was finished. I said, well, I guess the project's all done. And he said, no, you don't get it. You got to start thinking in phases. You know, I mean, I guess there's a certain wisdom to that if you're focused on paying off your house and stuff, and that's a good thing. The way we solved it here is we limit our interaction to clients to no more than 4 face-to-face meetings a month. Okay. So we actually put guidelines around our interaction with clients because we don't want to be, you know, Gerald Weinberg says to be pickled in the brine is the expression he uses. I think consultants get ineffective when you get to know them too well. Mm-hmm. The other expression we use in this business is you go native. Yeah. You start becoming an employee of the company you're working for, and that's never good. Yeah. Because you just want to be objective. So I think, you know, there's different kinds of consultants out there. I'm not going to criticize any of them, but our vision is that, you know, consultants are good for helping unstick you and helping to teach you and help you learn, but you don't want them doing the work for you.
So what are some of the important skills to teach? If we think of our audience here, yeah, technical leaders, what are some of the competencies they should be going out and saying, this is a muscle I need to build?
I think it's really important that they understand that they need to unlearn a lot of what they learned. And that's always hard for people to say, you know, everything I've gotten good at doing over the last 20 or 30 years, I have to undo a lot of it. And one of them is learning to not affix blame to a problem. So this is a huge problem. I mean, if you think about it, people are afraid to make decisions in big companies and especially in government because they're afraid of what will happen to them if they make the wrong decision. So fear drives a lot of friction in organizations. And, you know, one thing a leader can do is teach other people that failure is a good thing and failure is an opportunity to learn. And I always tell, you know, our clients, I'm like, you're probably going to fail. When would you like to fail? You know, when would you like to fail? And they say, well, I'd like to fail when, you know, when I haven't put too much effort into it. And I say, oh, you're onto something here. Now let's trace that one down. So, you know, so if you fail early, what does that mean? Well, that means you fail when it's cheap. You fail when not a lot of people know about it. You fail when you haven't hurt too many people by your failure. And so, you know, that just goes back to the agile values of fail fast and fail early, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, that's be the number one thing that I recommend is don't fear failure and don't worry about whose fault it is, because that is really the biggest problem is assignment of blame is a very powerful anti-pattern, and it drives negative behavior throughout the entire organization. So I say to, you know, leaders, say it out loud. When a problem happens, say, I don't want to know whose fault it is. I don't care. And the minute somebody tries to tell me whose fault it is, stop them and say, I don't care. What I want to know is what did we learn from this and how can we improve ourselves? Mm-hmm. So this urge to blame people and urge to get to the root cause of who caused it is the one, number one thing you need to undo mm-hmm. to do that. I think the other skill that's super important is how to build an infrastructure to let people self-organize. So this is a huge thing right now. There's a number of books that have been written lately about self-organization that are super popular, Holacracy and the book about the teal companies and the
organizations.
The organization, right? Yeah. And they all cover the same subject, and that is self-organization isn't magic. Mm. And that it isn't just saying to people, hey, people, go off and self-organize, you know, do your thing. That's actually demotivating to people when you do that. You know, when you tell people, you know, I'm not going to lead you anymore, go and self-organize. So I think that the learning there is that leadership and strong leadership is required for self-organization. But it's not the leadership you think it is, right? Or as they say it, I think it's Oldsmobile, they used to say, it's not your father's leadership. Right? It's totally different, right? and the kind of leadership that self-organizing teams, and that's what that's what enterprise agility is about, is self-organization, is about infrastructure, like teaching people how to teach others about building an infrastructure for self-organization. So what does that mean, right? I mean, some sort of governance infrastructure at multiple levels of the company, right? It means some way to filter up retrospectives and control them and capture the data. It means the use of data and visual information indicators around the organization, you know, big, huge signs and digital signs. There's lots of things in the infrastructure for self-organization that don't exist in a typical corporate environment. Co-located space, co-located teams, over-communicating outsized visual information indicators, governance at multiple levels, starting at the team and going all the way up, senior management's use of Kanban boards and Scrum boards and burn-down charts, demonstrating the culture. All these things are infrastructure items, right, that we don't think of as traditional leadership, but they're all about leadership. And people don't consider those.
That means we've got to, again, we're changing all of the rules of the organization. I think of the furniture police. You know, I want to move my desk 3 inches. No, you're not allowed to because there's a line here.
Yeah, or you can't take the next step in the development process because, you know, MKS Integrity has a gate and it won't let you pass that gate without the QA guy signing off. All right. And, you know, the QA guy is the guy who isn't busy doing something else. So that's why we gave him that role. And when, in fact, in a self-organizing world, our QA team should be our most senior people, our most experienced people who really know what they're looking at are, you know, people like yourself and me, maybe that know it all and have seen it all and say, oh, here's why you shouldn't do this, instead of someone with a clipboard and a red pen. It says, oh, according to my U.S. government approved process chart, you didn't execute on peer review type 3 based on your tailoring guidelines. You know, so we've kind of like painted ourselves in a corner light. So you're right. It's a complete reengineering of the way we work. But as a good friend of mine said to me recently, it's really simple. It's just hard.
And it's the hard that gets in the way, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's why we developed this model, because we had so many people coming to us and saying, you know, I like what you're saying. And, you know, I mean, you and I both know what I'm saying is nothing revolutionary. I mean, this is common thinking among agilists. They don't know how to do it. They literally don't know how to do it. And by they, I mean all levels of leadership. And it isn't even current leadership. It's all leadership. I mean, there's something about moving into the leadership and getting pickled in that brine that kind of freezes you and makes you forget about what it was like to actually be on the Agile team, right? Mm-hmm. So this model is this, what we call this Agile performance hierarchy. It's basically what we call a how-ability model. Mm-hmm. You know, you've heard of capability models, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maturity models. This is what we call a how-ability model. And it basically says, here's how we expect you to behave. Mm-hmm. And it addresses all levels of the organization and everything that we've talked about. So, you know, our theory is that it's not happening because they don't know how to make it happen. And if they knew how, they wouldn't be hiring thousands of consultants to advise them on how to do it. And they wouldn't have to ignore so much consultant advice if they knew how to do it themselves.
Anything else you'd like to touch on, Jeff?
This model we're talking about is a fairly new thing for us, and we're actually about to publish it to the market on May 3rd. We're doing what we call an Agile Leadership Camp in D.C., where we're going to publish this and announce it and hand it out to people. And one piece of it that we think is important is we've included an assessment piece. Mm-hmm. And we've given leaders the option to have themselves assessed, mm-hmm. Using this model as a baseline. There's really a baseline for healthy Agile performance. And the assessment model allows them to benchmark themselves at 3 levels, what we call the adopting Agile level, which is kind of an introductory, we're just getting started. And frankly, that's about 80% of the companies we've assessed so far have been there. We have the transforming level. These are companies that are really well on their way to adopting Agile values in an enterprise way and adopting agility across the teams. Then we have what we call the mastering level, and this is kind of a special thing. It's reserved for companies that have extended agility beyond development teams. Mm-hmm. So it's our view that unless operations, sales, marketing, procurement, IT services, unless all of these related and really interrelated organizations have also adopted Agile values and Agile frameworks and techniques, that the friction is just impossible to overcome. So, and I know, you know, business agility is a hot topic right now, and it's getting more and more popular. So we've reserved this mastering level for companies that want us to look at all parts of their organization, not just their software development. So we're announcing it on May 3rd. We're super excited about it. We've been doing a lot of work on it and a lot of good data in it.
Jeff, well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. If people want to get hold of you, where do they find you?
Best place to find us is at agilecxo.org. That's agilecxo.org. And if you just want to send an email, it's the info address there, or just go to the site and ping us. That site's going to have, it's got a couple of cool things on it for your viewers or your listeners, I guess. We've been doing a podcast series of Agile leaders from government the last year. So we've got 15 or 20 CIOs from various states in North America. And there's a number of videos of interviews there. And so you get a lot of good information, as well as the models and the research that we've done is also there at agilecxo.org.
Thanks very much.
All right, Shane. Thanks so much.